Oh, she claims. I heard she's not married, never been married. Lena looks from woman to woman. Is that true?
It's wrong is what it is,
Ada grumbles. Laura nods. You mean her not having a husband? Ada gives her a canny look.
I mean all of it. Living out there with the bishop like she is, and him allowing it.
I listen with interest as the women discuss the mysterious young woman living with Schrock. But some of my attention remains focused on Rebecca. I can't pin it down, but there's something going on with her. Tension seems to radiate from her. Is it stress? Anxiety? Fear? Bishop Schrock wouldn't... Lena struggles to finish the sentence. You know, he wouldn't... He's the bishop. Ada frowns.
He's a man, is what he is.
He saved her life, Lena says emphatically. He saved her soul from the devil.
Saved something for himself, more likely.
Rebecca spits the words as if they burn the inside of her mouth. Lena gapes at her, offended. He took her in when she had nowhere to go. He gave her proper clothing, taught her the Amish ways and the word of God. Rebecca doesn't back down.
Or maybe she's the one teaching him a thing or two.
I don't believe it, Lena hisses. Naomi reaches across the table and pats Lena's hand.
No one knows any such thing for sure.
Laura concentrates on her stitching. And who are we to judge?
Rebecca, how's the...
Across from me, Ada gasps, dropping the section of quilt she'd been working on. Oh, no.
Oh, no!
All eyes fly to Rebecca. For the first time, I notice the bandage covering the outside portion of her left hand. Oddly, she's been trying to hide it. Upon closer inspection, I discern the shape of her hand and realize her pinky finger is missing. No group of people knows better than the Amish that farming can be a dangerous profession. Accidents are commonplace, even for the women, who often help their husbands in the barn and fields. I'm not surprised by the sight of the missing digit. What I am surprised by is the reaction of the women. Surely this isn't the first time they've seen the result of a mishap that claimed a finger. Yes, those kinds of accidents are traumatic, but why the shock? And why would Rebecca try to conceal it? That's when it strikes me that no one has asked her what happened. They already know, a little voice whispers in my ear. The hair on the back of my neck prickles. I look down at the potholder in my hands, slide the needle into the fabric, and tug it through. What happened? I ask, matter-of-factly. Naomi stares at the bandage, her mouth open and trembling. Lena leans back in her chair, blinking. Laura looks down at her sewing, but her hands seem to be frozen in place. The room falls silent. Shifting uncomfortably, Rebecca lowers her hand so it's out of sight.
It was such a fool thing.
Her eyes flick to the door, then back to me. In the instant our eyes meet, I see fear in their depths.
I caught it in the meat grinder when I was making sausage.
The rise of tension is palpable, eyes averted. The women turn their attention back to their sewing, stitching faster, but not all hands are steady. How awful, I hear myself say. Did you go to the doctor?
Levi took me to the hospital.
She forces a laugh, but it's a loud, unnatural sound.
I don't think I'm going to be much help with this quilt.
Late afternoon ushers in a lowering sky with fog and another round of snow. By the time 5 o'clock rolls around, only Laura and I remain, and the shop is empty of customers. Earlier, she taught me how to use the old-fashioned cash register. In the last hour, I've rung up only 2 sales.
Might as well close up.
Laura joins me at the register, lays a $10 bill on the counter, and slides it over to me.
That's all I can afford to pay you.
I can't take your money. I slide it back to her. I didn't earn it.
You've manned the register most of the afternoon.
I've spent most of the afternoon drinking sweet coffee and eating your cookies. Kate! No. She softens. I wish the customers would come back. I love this shop. The people who used to come in. She lowers her voice. Just between us, I even like the tourists. I chuckle. I won't tell. I'm going to miss this place when I walk out for the last time. She drops a short stack of bills into a cash bag and zips it. I wipe the counter, trying to decide how best to broach the subject of Rebecca. I like your friends. They're like sisters to me, she replies. Some days, I don't know what I'd do without them. Terrible about Rebecca's finger, I say easily. My grossdaddy lost 2 in the corn thresher when I was a kid. Never slowed him down, though. Laura slides cookies from the plate into a container, concentrating a little too hard on the task. It happens. We work in silence for several minutes. Ada and Rebecca were pretty tough on Bishop Schrock, I say, trying to land on a subject that will keep her talking. They've got their reasons. I glance at her, trying to decipher the meaning, but her face gives me nothing. Did something happen between them and the bishop? Not Ada, she tells me. Rebecca. In my mind's eye, I see her bandaged hand. I recall the reactions of the other women, and I know there's something there, something important. I hope Laura trusts me enough to tell me what it is. What happened? I ask. Without replying, she walks to the front door and throws the deadbolt. Glancing through the plate glass window at the darkened street beyond, she lowers the blinds. Once they're closed tightly, she lifts a slat with her finger and peers out at the street. Finally, she leaves the window and ushers me to a table at the rear of the shop. What I'm about to tell you, she says in a low voice. Probably best if you don't repeat it. I offer a concerned, sympathetic look. Of course. I'm a firm believer that there are some things best left unsaid, some things most people are better off not knowing. I don't want to burden you, but I think you're a strong woman, and I'd like your perspective. She lets out a long breath. Honestly, I've been wanting to get this off my chest for some time. Reaching across the table, I squeeze her hand. What is it, Laura? Rebecca and I have been friends for a lot of years. We've had babies at the same time, husband troubles, and we've eaten more than our share of fattening cookies. Smiling wistfully, she looks down at the cookie in her hand. Last summer, she came to me, crying, Kate. The story she told me, I didn't know what to make of it. Shaking her head, she lets the words trail. I didn't want to believe it, but let me tell you, it sent a knife through my heart. What happened? A gust of wind rattles the windows. Laura startles, her eyes jerking to the door. She covers her reaction with a laugh, but for the first time, she looks frightened. Rebecca told me that 2 of her granddaughters, just 13 and 14 years old, and her 16-year-old grandson, were taken in and counseled by Bishop Schrock. The children spent 4 nights at the bishop's farmhouse. She looks down at the tabletop. She said the 2 girls weren't the same when they came out. They wouldn't talk about it, wouldn't tell anyone what went on. Rebecca claims the bishop turned them against her. Turned them against her how? I ask. Evidently, the girls wanted nothing to do with her, wouldn't speak to her or visit with her and Levi, her husband. Rebecca blames the bishop, says he took them from her. She's bitter, and that's not the Amish way. She shudders. Some of the things she says about the bishop. Terrible things. Like what? She shakes her head, letting me know she won't repeat them. What do you think happened to the girls? I ask. She shrugs. I know how it must look to an outsider, like the bishop overstepped. But in his defense, those girls had become prideful. I could see a wildness in them. And little Andy, with the drinking and smoking. There's no doubt those kids were heading down the wrong road. She shakes her head. There's so much temptation in the world for the young people these days. That much is true, I say. Kate, I've seen the bishop with the youngsters. He's good with them. But it doesn't elude me that she says the words as if she's not only trying to convince me, but herself. Some might say he's too firm, but I think he's seen the devil at work, and he knows the power of evil. I think he saw the direction they were going, and somehow talked all the temptation right out of their heads. I stare at her, my mind reeling with the knowledge that Schrock is a predatory son of a bitch. After what he did to me, the thought of what might have happened to two innocent Amish girls twists my gut into knots. Rebecca wants to leave Roaring Springs, she tells me. She wants to go back to her old church district in Ohio. The bishop asked her and Levi to stay, but I don't think they will. Honestly, I don't blame her, with her grandchildren and children gone. They left? Rebecca's son and daughter-in-law, Big Andy and Irene, packed up and left in the middle of the night, shortly after it happened. Took the girls with them. Left without a word. Didn't even tell Rebecca. Poor woman didn't even get a chance to say goodbye. I put the names to memory, so Suggs can run them through the various law enforcement databases. In the back of my mind, I'm wondering how Rebecca's missing digit fits into all this. Where did they go? I ask. Shipshewana, Indiana, I think. What about the grandson? I ask. Though the shop is locked down tight, the blinds pulled, her eyes flick toward the front of the store, as if she's expecting someone to come through the door. I find my own gaze following hers, the hairs at my nape standing on end. Little Andy never came back, she whispers. What? But where did he go? Evidently, the bishop sent the boy to another church district in Missouri to help an elderly couple whose family was killed in a buggy accident. Suspicion creeps over me, as cold and hard as January ice spreading over the surface of a pond. Without speaking to his parents? I mean, did the boy want to go? Did he volunteer? No one knows, and no one's talking. Did Rebecca confront the bishop? I ask. She's not one to take things sitting down. The smile that follows is humorless and tight. She's a strong-willed woman and isn't afraid to speak her mind. I don't know everything that was said, but there's bad blood between them now. Around us, the shop is eerily silent. The only sound is the occasional hiss of tires on Main Street, the rattle of heat coming from the vent overhead. Laura, I whisper, did the bishop do something bad to the children? The words hover, like the smell of something long dead that neither of us wants to acknowledge. She stares at me, anguish and fear etched into her features. I can't imagine, Kate. I mean, he's the bishop. He's a mortal man, I tell her. A human being with weaknesses just like the rest of us. Maybe more, from what I've heard. I think I've said enough. She starts to rise, but I reach out and set my hand on her arm. Laura, did the bishop have something to do with what happened to Rebecca's hand? Pulling her arm away, she rises so abruptly that the chair legs screech across the floor. Without looking at me, she shoves it against the table. The shop no longer feels homey or cozy or even comfortable. It feels like a dangerous place that's exposed and watched. I can't. Turning away, she walks to the counter. I rise and follow. Did someone hurt Rebecca? I shouldn't have told you any of this. I shouldn't be burdening you with my worries. I'm glad you did. When she says nothing, I add, that's what friends are for. When she turns to face me, she's pulled herself together. Her eyes are cool when they meet mine. I think it's time you went home, Kate. But what about... She cuts me off. If you're smart, you'll forget we ever had this conversation. Chapter 16. Everything I learned from Laura Hirschberger and the other women at the quilt shop churns in my brain as I take the scooter bike back to the trailer. Bishops don't take teenage girls into their homes to counsel. They don't send teenaged boys away without the blessing of the children's parents. Families don't flee their homes in the middle of the night, unless they're frightened of something or someone. What really happened to Rebecca and her family? All I can do at this point is continue to ask questions, keep digging. In the interim, I'll pass along the information to Sugg so he can run the names. Hopefully, he'll be able to locate them and find out what happened. It's nearly dark by the time I arrive at the trailer. While soup heats on the stove, I call Suggs and recap my conversation with Laura Hirschberger. The grandson never came back. Allegedly, he was sent to Missouri to help an elderly couple after their family was killed in a buggy accident.
That's checkable. I'll get with the highway patrol down there and see if they can get me stats on fatality accidents involving buggies. And of course, I'll run their names.
While you're at it, run the parents and the two girls, too, will you? Last name, Beiler. I spell it for him. I don't know the girls' first names, but I'll work on it.
All right.
He sighs.
Damn, this whole thing stinks. Kids disappearing. Entire families running in the middle of the night.
He goes silent, and then asks,
You been able to get a look at any of the kids around there?
I saw a few at worship on Sunday. No visible signs of physical abuse. Most were bundled up, but no odd behavior or marked-up faces.
Doesn't mean it's not there.
Neither of us mentions the fact that some of the worst kind of abuse doesn't leave physical marks.
All these rumors, the sheriff says with distaste. God only knows what the hell is going on out there. Remember what I said, Kate. If things get too dicey, we can pull you out at any time.
I got it under control, I tell him. As I end the call, I wonder how many cops have said those very words, only to realize they weren't true. I spend a couple of hours struggling with my sewing project. By the time 10 p.m. rolls around, I'm frustrated and cold and ready to call it a night. It's not until midnight that I fall into a fitful slumber. Dreams of Rachel Esch invade my sleep. We're sitting at the sewing table at the Calico Country Store. I'm stitching a crib quilt that's nearly finished, but no matter how hard I try, I can't manage the final stitches. Rachel and Laura stare at the mess I've made of it, and I can tell by their expressions that they've realized the work isn't mine, that I'm no seamstress, and my secret has been found out. Laura looks at me with knowing eyes. She's not one of us, she tells Rachel. Sie hat ein falsch Amish. She's a phony Amish. The girl replies, but I don't hear the words. Her lips are blue, and I can tell by the gray hue of her face that she's dead. Her front teeth are broken to the gum, blood between her teeth, ice on her lips. Her smile is macabre. We're going to have to tell the bishop, she whispers. I'm trying to save you, I tell the girl. Rachel throws her head back, and a terrible laugh spills from her bloody mouth. No one can save me. I wake in a cold sweat and sit bolt upright. Around me, the trailer is quiet and freezing cold. I'm breathing hard, and in the thin light slanting in through the window, I can see the vapor of my breath. Tossing the blankets aside, I throw my legs over the side of the bed and rise to turn up the heat. I'm midway down the hall when I see a shadow shift in the living room. I go still, squint into the darkness. Another wave of cold air wraps around my ankles and slinks up my legs. The front door is open, I realize, and a different kind of cold stabs me in the back. Something scrapes across the carpet 10 feet away, and in that instant, I know I'm not alone. Adrenaline burns like fire in my gut. My .22 and phone are beneath the mattress. I spin, dash toward the bedroom. Heavy footfalls right behind me. I reach the bed, drop to my knees, jam my hands beneath the mattress. My fingertips brush steel. Heavy hands slam down on my shoulders and yank me backward. The fabric of my flannel shirt tears. I lose my balance, fall onto my back, my head bouncing off the floor. Stars fly in front of my eyes.
"Drag her out here,"
a male voice says. "Get your hands off me!" I draw back and punch at his face. My fist grazes his temple. "Get off!" A second hand grasps my right arm, yanks hard, dragging me down the hall and into the living room. I twist, get my knees under me, try to scramble to my feet. I see the silhouettes of two men, snowsuits and ski masks. Then I'm yanked forward. My knees go out from under me, and I'm being dragged on my stomach. Again I twist, get one knee beneath me. I try to jerk my arm from the man's grip, but his hand is a vice, crushing bone and bruising flesh. Using my free arm, I drive my fist into his crotch. His gasp ends in a roar. His grip loosens. I jerk my hand away. In an instant, I'm on my feet. "Get out!" I scream. "Get out!" Spinning, I sprint toward the bedroom for my weapon. He tackles me midway down the hall. I fall hard on my stomach. My chin scrapes the carpet. My attacker comes down on top of me. I hear his laugh, hear his partner running toward us. I twist, bring up both feet, and mule kick him in the gut. He reels backward, crashes to the floor on his ass.
"Grab that bitch," he pants.
I flip over, scrabble toward the bedroom, my brain chanting, "Get the gun, get the gun." I dive toward the bed. A hand comes down on the back of my head, shoves me down hard, slamming my face against the floor. My nose crunches. Pain zings up my sinuses. My arms collapse beneath me. I feel the warmth of blood coursing from my nose, taste copper at the back of my throat. Son of a bitch! I try to turn over to kick him again, but both men are on me now, pressing me down.
"Got a mouth on her, don't she?"
one of the men hisses.
"Guess someone needs to teach her some manners."
My head reels. I lie still, taking physical stock, trying to regain my senses. Roughly, they flip me onto my back. I look up at them, keenly aware that my gown has ridden up, exposing my bare legs and underwear. My heart sinks when one of the men removes a roll of duct tape from beneath his coat. "Don't do it," I say. The other man's hand snakes out and clamps around my throat, cutting off the blood flow to my head.
"Give me your hands or I'll fucking knock you out."
I extend my hands in front of me. The other man tapes my wrists together. Fear crashes over me when I realize I'm done. I can't get to my 22, can't get to my cell. I'm at their mercy, and there's not a damn thing I can do to help myself. "Who are you?" I try to maintain a level of authority in my voice. I'm appalled when it quavers. "Why are you doing this?" The men ignore me.
"Get up,"
one of them says, and without waiting for me to comply, they haul me to my feet. I look from man to man. Both are wearing ski masks and snowsuits. "I haven't seen your faces," I tell them. "I don't know who you are." The men exchange looks, but say nothing. "Let me go, and we'll forget this happened," I say quickly. "I won't tell anyone. You have my word."
"Yeah, right,"
one of them mutters. "Tell me what you want," I say. "I'll do it."
"You and that big mouth of yours will find out soon enough,"
one of the men tells me.
"Let's go,"
says the other. He takes my arm, drags me into the living room. I know they're going to take me outside. God only knows what will happen once they do. Last time I checked my phone, the temperature was 18 degrees. I try another tactic.
"I need to get dressed,"
I tell them.
"You're dressed just fine,"
the man behind me replies.
"I'll freeze,"
I say.
"We better put a coat on her,"
the other puts in. The man grasping my arm stops, gives me a rough shake.
"Where's it at?"
My barn coat is draped over the back of the bar stool facing the kitchen. I cock my head toward it. "You're going to have to untie me, so I can put it on." The other man brushes past us and snatches up the coat. Facing me, he drapes it over my shoulders, yanks it tight, and fastens it with the big safety pin, without putting my arms through the sleeves.
"There you go. Nice and warm."
The other man kicks my sneakers over to me, then kneels and shoves them onto my feet, cinching the laces tightly. Together, they force me through the living room, out the door, and onto the deck. As they drag me down the steps, I realize these are the same men I saw last night with the two women. They're Amish. I can tell by their accents. And I'm pretty sure they're going to kill me. When you're working undercover and your gig goes south, it usually happens so fast that any hope of initiating some brilliantly conceived contingency plan flies out the window. Usually at about the same time you realize Plan B wasn't quite as brilliant as you'd initially thought anyway. My emergency plan had been pretty simple. Grab the cell and the 22 mini mag and hope 5 shots are enough. The best I can hope for now is the opportunity to run. Don't let down your guard. Tomasetti's words ring hard in my ears as we trudge through the snow to 2 snowmobiles parked 100 yards into the woods. Before mounting, one of the men, the one I kicked in the groin, reaches out, grasps my throat with his right hand, and squeezes hard enough to cut off the blood to my head. Even in the darkness, I see the threat in his eyes as he peers at me through the slits of the ski mask. "You do anything stupid, and I'll put a rope around your neck and drag you," he snarls. "You got that?" I nod, and he releases me. "Where are you taking me?" I ask. The other man removes a stocking cap from beneath his coat, pulls it over my head, yanking it down over my eyes and most of my face. Then I'm lifted and put on the back part of the seat. I feel him climb on in front of me. "Shut up and hold on to my coat," he tells me. The engine revs, and the snow machine lurches forward. For the first few minutes of the ride, I entertain fantasies of jumping off and running into the woods under cover of the night. I take refuge in the trees, somehow loosen the binds at my wrists, and make my way back to the trailer. Once there, I'd arm myself with my .22, contact Suggs, and kill anyone who came through the door before the sheriff's department arrived. All the while, my mind races through a myriad of unpleasant reasons why I'm here. Are they taking me to Schrock so he can finish what he started? Worse, does he somehow know who I am? Are they planning to kill me? The most pressing issue is the cold. I'm not dressed for temperatures in the teens. I'm certainly not dressed for a middle-of-the-night snowmobile ride when wind chills are undoubtedly below zero. As we zip through the darkness, weaving between trees and over deadfall, the cold is like a blade cutting into my flesh and sinking deeper with every mile. It penetrates my clothes, a nightgown, flannel shirt, and barn coat, and sucks the breath from my lungs. Within minutes, my entire body is quaking uncontrollably. My teeth chatter. My face and hands have long since gone numb. As much as I don't want to get close to the driver, I lean against him, using his body to block the wind. I try to work at the tape binding my wrists, but it takes all my strength just to hold on. I use the driver's back to scrape at the hat covering my face. Eventually, I'm able to inch it up enough so that I can see. Even then, all I can see are snow and trees flying by, none of which look familiar. We're on the snowmobile for less than 10 minutes. By the time the engine slows, the cold has rendered me utterly useless. My hands and knees and feet are numb. I'm shivering so violently, I can barely stay astride the seat. Tilting my head back for a better view, I try to get a look at my surroundings. We've arrived at a farm surrounded by hundreds of 60-foot-tall trees, a large bank barn and paddock ahead, 2-story frame house to my left. We've stopped a few yards from a small outbuilding. Nothing looks familiar. The gravity of the situation drops into my gut like stone. I have no idea where I am or why these men have brought me here. I have no mode of communication, no weapon, and not nearly enough protective clothing. In cop speak, I'm in serious shit. I can't help but think of Rachel Esch. She froze to death not far away from here. Is this the way it went down? Did these men come for her in the middle of the night? Did she get away from them and run into the woods? Did they look for her? Or did they know she wouldn't make it and simply let her die in the snowstorm? In the back of my mind, I consider telling the two men that I'm a cop, that if I die, they'll be caught and more than likely face the death penalty. As much as I don't want to blow my cover and waste the time and effort invested in this operation thus far, it might be the only way to save my life. But despite the risks and the fact that I'm not in control of the situation, some inner voice urges me to wait. I'll keep my options open. For now, I want to see where this goes. I want to know who's behind it. The driver of the machine I'm on dismounts. I'm aware of his partner behind us, headlight illuminating us. The next thing I know, the driver turns, sets his hand against my chest, and shoves me hard. I slide from the seat and plop into the snow on my backside. Laughter erupts. Using my hands, I scrape the hat up over my eyes so I can see and look around. One of the men is standing next to the outbuilding. Only then do I realize it's a chicken coop. Shit. Shit. Get up. I bend my knees, try to get my legs under me, but wobble and fall sideways. He doesn't give me a second chance. Bending to me, he wraps both hands around my biceps and hauls me to my feet. Cut the tape, he says to the other man. A different kind of fear goes through me at the sight of the 4-inch folding knife. I raise my bound wrists, watching as he severs the tape. Get in the coop. I turn to face him. I need to get warm, I sputter through chattering teeth. Gloves. How about if I knit you a pair? Now get in there. His partner fumbles with a padlock on a hasp and with some effort shoves open the door. The other man clamps his hand around the back of my neck and forces me toward the door. Beyond, the interior is dark and smells of frozen chicken shit and dirt. I don't want to go in there, I say the words in Pennsylvania Dutch. This is what we do to nosy Amish women. Raising his foot, he places it on my butt and shoves me through the door. I stumble into the darkened interior, smack my forehead against something, and fall to my hands and knees. Something scampers across the dirt floor to my right. Rat, I think, but I'm too cold to care. The door slams shut. I struggle to my feet, strike my head against a low beam, and duck back down. A roost. Rushing to the door, I slam both fists against it. Let me out! I scream. Let me out! A round of laughter ensues, followed by conversation I can't quite discern. The snowmobile engines rev. Don't leave! I slam my fist against the door. Bastards! The men drive away. I stand at the door. Through a gap between the wood planks, I watch the taillights fade into the darkness. The sound of the engines fade. Dismay spreads through me. And then the men are gone. Pricks! I stand there, shaking with cold and rage and disbelief. I'm somehow incredulous the situation has deteriorated to this. If I don't play my cards right, it'll soon become a life-or-death scenario. Turning, I face the interior of the coop. Weak gray light creeps in through the gaps between the weathered wood siding. There's a small door that's about 2 feet square and at ground level on the far end for the chickens, but it's closed. There are no chickens in sight. I can tell by the smell they haven't been gone long. The place is dirty, and though I'm protected from the wind, cold as hell. I make my way to the chicken door and kick it. It's solidly closed. There's probably a crossboard nailed across it on the outside. There are no windows. I go back to the large door, shove at it with both hands, but it's secure. Using my shoulder, I get a running start and bang against it. The door shudders beneath the force of my weight. I ram it again and again. I bring my foot up and kick it as hard as I can, but it refuses to give way. The sons of bitches put the padlock back on. I can hear it rattling on the outside. I'm breathing hard from the physical effort. My shoulder hurts from the impact. My hands ache with cold. I can't feel my fingers at all. I'm wearing sneakers with the socks I went to bed in, but they're not enough to keep my feet warm or even ward off frostbite. But the physical activity has alleviated the worst of the shaking. For now. Half a dozen outcomes float uneasily through my brain. As far as I know, the men have left me here to freeze to death. I wonder if that's the way it went down for Rachel Esch. Did they leave her here to die, and then dump her body in the woods so the police would believe she'd perished in the storm? But why? Did she spurn Schrock's advances? Did she see something she shouldn't have? This is what we do to nosy Amish women. Have I been asking too many questions? Is that what this is about? Or does this have something to do with the two women I saw with the men on snowmobiles? Were those women somehow harmed? Are the men afraid I'll identify them? The problem with that scenario is I didn't see their faces. I couldn't identify them. If not that, then what? The bottom line is, I've been careless. I've spurned Schrock's advances. I've asked too many questions. I fooled myself into believing I was being careful. In reality, I'd committed the mortal sin of undercover work. I underestimated the perspicacity of my enemy. Pacing the confines of the coop, swinging my arms to keep the blood circulating, I mentally cataloged the people I talked to. Mary and Abe Gingrich, their daughter, Anna, Laura Hirschberger, the women at the quilt shop, Marie Weaver. The one event that supersedes the rest is my visit with Schrock. Of all the possible culprits, he's the one who wields the power and has the authority to direct someone to do this, all without getting his hands dirty. If I freeze to death tonight, no one will ever know what happened. As with Rachel Esch's death, the coroner will be able to determine the cause of death, which would probably be hypothermia, but not the manner of death, which would be homicide. I made it easy for them. Instead of letting the thought shake me, I use it to spur my temper. Starting in the nearest corner, I feel my way around the perimeter of the coop, testing each piece of siding as I go. The structure is about 20 by 12 feet. There are two roosts at about head level. The floor is hard-packed dirt. One wall is a maze of nesting boxes where the hens lay eggs. The large door is solidly secure, so I go back to the chicken door. I lower myself to the ground, a couple of feet away from it, bring my feet up, and plant a double-barrel kick in the center. Once, twice, three times. Come on, I pant. The fourth blow cracks wood. Encouraged, I kick it again as hard as I can. One of the planks splits. Half of it pulls away from the frame. Another kick, and my foot blasts through the hole. A wood sliver slices my calf as I pull it back through. I don't care. A final kick, and the plank flies off and lands in the snow outside. Then I'm on my knees, shoving at the loosened wood with my hands. It's not a quiet process. If there's anyone nearby, there's no doubt they've heard my assault on the chicken door. Someone could be waiting for me on the other side. I pick up a split piece of siding to keep with me, in case I need to defend myself. When the opening is large enough to accommodate me, I go to my hands and knees and slither through. I find myself in an aviary constructed of chicken wire, steel T-posts, and a few 4x4 wood braces. It's just high enough for me to stand upright. I wish for wire cutters as I walk the perimeter. Relief leaps through me when I realize the wire is attached to the structure with only a few fencing staples. I try yanking it with my hands, but the effort is unsuccessful, so I throw my shoulder against it. The chicken wire stretches and bends, and then snaps away from the building. I work my way down to the bottom, peel back the wire, and slide through. Free of the coop, I dart around to the other side of the building. Though the moon is obscured by clouds and the shadows of the trees, there's enough light for me to make out the track marks of the snowmobiles. They went in the opposite direction from where we came in. Taking off at a run, I retrace the tracks back toward the trailer. Chapter 17. By the time I arrive back at the trailer, I'm in bad shape. I'm no longer shivering. The cold burns my lungs. My heart is pounding so hard my chest hurts. I can't hear anything over the roar of blood in my ears. At some point, I drop the piece of wood. Someone could sneak up on me and I wouldn't hear them approach. I sure as hell wouldn't be able to do anything about it. I stagger like a drunk as I round the end of the trailer, and for a crazy instant, I can't remember where the door is. Then I see the stairs and lurch toward the deck. At the foot of the steps, I stumble and go to my knees. All I can think about is getting inside. I'm not sure I can stand, so I climb the steps on my hands and knees. Gripping the doorknob, I pull myself to my feet and open the door. I totter to the bedroom, fall to my knees, and pull my .22 from beneath the mattress. I know my phone is there too, but in my confused state, I can't find it. Gripping the .22 with both hands, I leave the bedroom, keeping my eyes on the windows as I walk back to the living room. I stand there a moment, my head swimming, trying to decide what to do next. I'm aware that I'm experiencing the initial stage of hypothermia, but the knowledge doesn't help. I can't remember if I locked the door, so I go to it, twist the lock. I head to the kitchen, drag a chair to the door, and wedge it beneath the knob. Dizziness presses down on me when I straighten, and I have to lean against the bar. The shivers are starting to return. I make my way back to the kitchen, fill the kettle with water, and light all four burners. I don't set down my revolver, instead warming one hand at a time over the flame, knowing it's going to be painful when the feeling returns. I find a mug and a tea bag and pour hot water. I sip the tea without tasting, trying to get the hydration and warmth into my body. My hand is shaking so violently, some of it sloshes over the side of the cup. I go to the table and sit. I'm nauseous and hungry at once. My hands and feet ache. The skin on my face and my ears burn. And for the first time, I worry about frostbite. As bad as it is, though, my mind is beginning to clear. By the time I pour a second cup of tea, I feel steady enough to call Suggs.
Yeah?
He answers in a sleep-rough voice. I have no idea what time it is. It's Burkholder.
Chief, what the... Is everything okay?
No. I hear rustling on the other end.
What's going on?
He says, urgency and concern sharp in his voice. A couple of guys on snowmobiles broke into the trailer, caught me sleeping. I couldn't get to my phone or weapon, and they hauled me away, locked me in a fucking chicken coop.
What? Kate, what the hell? Who?
I'm pretty sure it was the same men I saw with those women night before last.
You get names? Description?
No. Dan, they wore ski masks. All I know is that they're young, early 20s maybe, and Amish.
Shit. Are you okay?
I barely made it back to the trailer. Those sons of bitches left me in that coop to freeze to death.
How long ago?
I look at the clock on the stove. 2 hours.
Look, Kate, you're slurring words. Unless you've been hitting the booze, you're probably hypothermic. I'm going to get an ambulance.
No, I cut in. I'm fine now. I just need to get warm.
You sure you don't need to get yourself checked out? I can be there in 10 minutes and take you to the ER myself. No one will be the wiser.
Sheriff, I'm okay. I made hot tea. I'm on my second cup. Going to bundle up in a minute, get my core temp back up. I thought you should know what happened.
Hell yes I should know.
He snaps the words, and I sense him reeling in his temper, trying to be patient with me.
I'm glad you're okay. How did they gain entry?
I don't know. The door was locked. A beat of silence as he mulls that bit of information.
Is it possible they have a key?
If the landlady rents to the Amish and doesn't change the locks between tenants, it's possible.
I use a locksmith here in Roaring Springs. I can get him out there first light.
I know this sounds paranoid, but if someone's watching the trailer, it might be better if I change it myself.
What about tonight? What if they come back?
It'll be the last time they walk into someone's home uninvited. He makes a sound of discomfort.
You sure you're okay?
I'm warming up. Hands and feet hurt.
I meant what I said before, Kate. If you want to end this, just say the word. We'll get you out pronto, no problem. Do you understand?
The prospect of going home tantalizes me. My mind flashes to my big farmhouse kitchen, the ever-present smells of coffee and potpourri, Tomasetti singing off-key in the shower, the police station with my cramped little office and beat-up desk. At this moment, they're the most comforting images in the world. The cop inside me rejects any notion of comfort. I need to finish this assignment, especially now that someone has made it personal. Maybe it's my ego talking, a reflection of my anger at being bested and hurt, but there's no way I can walk away. I need to know who tried to kill me tonight and why. I have a feeling once I do, I'll know what happened to Rachel Esch. I'm going to finish this, I tell him.
I appreciate that, Kate, I really do. But the last thing anyone wants is for you to put yourself at risk. You've gone above and beyond already.
He pauses.
I don't have to tell you that what happened to you tonight could have turned out a hell of a lot worse.
I know exactly what could have happened. I won't let my guard down again.
All right.
He shifts gears.
Any idea why these two men would risk getting into trouble with the law to lock you in a chicken coop? What could they hope to gain?
Since they believe I'm Amish, they're betting I won't go to the police. Most Amish, particularly the Old Order and Schwarzentruber, would rather handle things on their own than involve outsiders.
Okay, I'll buy that. I've seen it. But why do it at all?
To send me a message. Intimidate me. I repeat what one of the men told me. This is what we do to nosy Amish women. It's interesting that he used the word we.
That confirms it's a concerted effort, that there are others involved.
I've been asking a lot of questions. Too many, probably.
Someone noticed.
I consider that a moment. Dan, had I died in that coop, and I was indeed an Amish widow from another state, my death probably would have gone unnoticed and unreported.
That'll put a chill in your damn spine.
He heaves another sigh.
I guess it's safe to say you've officially pissed off Schrock.
I turned down his advances. Maybe that ruffled his ego.
Do you think he made you as a cop?
No. He thinks I don't know my place.
Or whoever you've been talking to went to Schrock, or mentioned it to someone who did. Any ideas? The woman at the quilt shop?
I can't see her going to Schrock. I take a long swig of tea. Dan, I've talked to a lot of people since I arrived. It could have been any of them. I sigh. Guess I wasn't being as subtle as I thought.
That son of a bitch is using some pretty heavy-handed intimidation tactics. If he's responsible for half the shit that's going on, he's dangerous as hell.
There's no doubt in my mind.
It goes against my better judgment to leave you in there.
Dan, I'm just now getting to the meat of this. Just a few more days. I'll be careful. Suggs groans.
Something like this happens again and you're out. You got that?
I got it. I choose my next words carefully. Would you do me a favor and not mention this to Tomasetti?
Oh, boy,
he mutters.
Are you two...
Well...
I have no reason to mention any of this to Tomasetti, but I have to keep Betancourt up to speed.
I'd appreciate it if the two of you kept it between you.
I'll do my best,
he says. Thanks, Dan.
If I were you, I'd start sleeping with that .38 under my pillow,
the sheriff tells me. I plan to, I reply. Talk to you tomorrow.
Night, Chief.
Fear and sleep make incompatible bedfellows. Throw post-hypothermic exhaustion into the mix, and you have a long and excruciating night. To make matters worse, I bedded down on the sofa. I couldn't bear the thought of someone breaking in and not hearing them from the back bedroom. When I finally dozed off at 5 a.m., I had my .38 in my hand, the hammer back, and my cell in the other. Lucky for everyone involved, the men never showed. I woke a couple hours later, clear-headed, and fully recovered from my ordeal in the chicken coop. At some point during the night, it occurred to me that if the men had wanted to kill me, they could have done so. I don't believe that was their intent, though if I had succumbed to the cold, they wouldn't have been too broken up about it. Interestingly, I didn't see a firearm on either man. Often when a criminal is armed and wants control of his victim, he will brandish a weapon. I'm not convinced they were armed, which is telling. I'm working on my second cup of coffee when I notice the chafing and bruising on my wrists from the tape. A small blister is beginning to rise on the pad of my left ring finger, probably from frostbite. I'll need to keep an eye on it in the coming days and watch for any sign of tissue loss or infection. I dress for the day, adding an extra layer for warmth, and at 7:30 I leave the trailer and take the scooter bike to the farm store for a new lock. The Roaring Springs feed store is about 20 minutes away. I arrive just as the cashiers are opening their registers. Grabbing a shopping cart, I head for hardware. I grab two commercial-duty bolt locks and the tools I'll need to install them. On impulse, I add a couple of heavy-duty zinc-plated barrel bolt locks. Then I'm off to sporting goods. There, I'm quickly reminded that stun guns are illegal in the state of New York. It takes me less than a minute to locate the pepper spray. I choose a compact canister filled with the highest percentage of oleoresin capsicum. The label boasts 25 bursts with minimal blowback, and it's made in the USA. If my attackers return, I'll be ready. Back at the trailer, I set to work. Installing a bolt lock isn't rocket science, and I'm relatively handy, or so I'd imagined. The job isn't as easy as I anticipated. The lack of power tools doesn't help, and a chore that would have taken a locksmith an hour ends up taking me close to 3. The locks aren't straight, and the jam is nicked, but the trailer is secure. I fix hot soup from a can for lunch. As I eat, I pull out my phone, call up Google, and retrieve an address for Abe and Mary Gingrich. It's not far. I'll stop by under the guise of thanking them for driving me to worship on Sunday, and see if I can get Mary to open up about the bruise on her face. The afternoon has turned colder, with a brisk wind whipping down from the north. Dark clouds roil above the tree line to my left, prompting me to push the scooter bike faster as I head west. It takes me just 10 minutes to reach their small farm. It's a single-story stone house with asphalt shingles and a big chimney that's puffing smoke. A sway-backed outbuilding that had once been a detached garage is being used to house goats. A greenhouse in the side yard is missing half its panes and falling to ruin. Beyond, I see the raised landscape timbers of a garden. No shutters on the house. No clay pots left over from summer. No adornment of any kind. The place is plain. I stop the bike in the gravel driveway, dismount, and lean it against a bare-branched maple a few feet away. The wind cuts through my coat, its icy hands rushing up my skirt and down my collar. By the time I reach the front door, I'm shivering, despite the physical exertion of the ride. The door opens, and Mary Gingrich appears. "Kate?" Craning her neck, she looks past me, as if to see if I'm alone. She doesn't look pleased to see me. She has a full-fledged black eye now, and I wonder, what kind of person assaults a middle-aged Amish woman? The same kind that leaves a 15-year-old girl out in the cold to die. "I thought I'd swing by to thank you and Abe for driving me to worship on Sunday," I say.
"No need to thank us.
May I come in?" I add a shiver for effect. She offers a pained expression. She doesn't want to invite me inside, but her good manners prevent her from refusing.
"Come on."
The living room smells of wood smoke and some kind of frying meat. It's a small space with a worn oak floor covered with a braided rug. The furniture is minimal. Plain brown sofa covered with a half dozen homemade throw pillows. Rocking chair draped with a blue and white afghan. An overstuffed chair and ottoman face a pot-bellied stove in the corner. The curtains are black.
"I hope I'm not interrupting your afternoon," I tell her.
"I was just frying up some speck for sandwiches.
Bacon.
Would you like to stay?
I can't, but thank you.
An awkward silence falls. The room is so quiet, I can hear the bacon sizzling in the kitchen. Mary looks everywhere except at me.
Mary, I need to talk to you about something that happened.
Her gaze jerks to mine. In the depths of her eyes, I see apprehension, maybe even fear.
Two men on snowmobiles came to my trailer last night, I tell her. They broke in while I was sleeping, tied me up, and took me to a farm where I was locked in a chicken coop.
She makes all the appropriate noises, even manages to widen her eyes. But it's a practiced response. She's not surprised, and she's not a very good liar.
But why would they do such a thing?
To harm me, intimidate me. I shrug. I don't know. Her gaze slinks away from mine. I wait, but she says nothing. It doesn't escape me that she fails to ask if the men were Amish or what they looked like. I gesture to her black eye.
I thought you might be able to shed some light.
I don't see how.
The men were Amish, early 20s.
I pause, push harder.
I'm betting they're the same men who gave you that shiner and put that mark on your neck.
Pressing her hand to her chest, she takes a step back.
Oh, Kate.
It's the first honest reaction I've seen. It's obvious she's hiding something, maybe even protecting someone.
But who? And why? Who put those marks on your face? I ask.
A laugh squeezes from her throat. I've no idea who you're talking about.
I think those men came to you, too. I think they hurt you. And I think you're afraid to talk about it, because you're afraid they'll come back and do it again.
Selis nix, as bafzes. That's nothing but trifling talk. But her gaze drops to the floor, as if she can't lie and look me in the eye at the same time.
Who are they, Mary?
Tilting my head slightly, I make eye contact with her, refuse to release her gaze.
Why are they hurting people?
Her laugh is the high-pitched trill of a nervous bird.
I don't know what you're talking about. Nothing you say will leave this room, I tell her. You have my word.
A quiver moves through her, so minute I almost miss it. But I'm good at reading people, their thoughts, their emotions. She wants to open up. She wants to release the ugly truth trapped inside her. But this woman isn't merely frightened. She's terrified.
I nearly froze to death last night, I tell her. Those men are dangerous. They need to be stopped.
There's nothing you can do, she whispers. No one can stop them. Just live quietly, and they'll leave you alone.
You live quietly, and look what they did to you.
You know nothing, she hisses. I try a different tactic.
Maybe I should talk to the bishop.
Do not speak of this to the bishop, she says quickly.
Why?
He won't stand for that kind of behavior. She starts to turn away, but I reach out and gently grasp her arm.
Mary, talk to me, please.
Leave this house, now.
We both startle at the sound of Abe's voice. I turn to find him standing in the kitchen doorway. He stares at me without expression, his eyes as lifeless as a mannequin's.
You think you know so much,
he says quietly.
You know nothing of the way things work here. Nothing.
Then help me understand, I say back. Talk to me.
Leave us alone.
He motions toward the door.
Go.
Uneasiness pricks the back of my neck when I notice the large bandage encompassing his right hand. The dime-sized spot of blood.
What happened to your hand? I ask.
Mary turns away. A sob escapes her. Abe leaves his place at the doorway and moves closer. No one answers for the span of a full minute. I'm aware of the fire crackling, sleet striking the window on the west side of the house, the steady thrum of my heart, that little voice in the back of my head warning me to tread carefully.
An accident,
the Amish man tells me,
in the workshop.
I look from Abe to Mary, and back to Abe.
You're lying. Anger flashes in his eyes, but it's laced with something else I can't quite read. Fear? Panic? His face is such a jumble of emotions I can't discern which.
You did this. You!
He looks down at his hand.
All the questions and sticking your nose in places it doesn't belong. Look what you've stirred up. Look what you've done to us.
Is this the way you want to live your lives? In fear? I motion toward Mary. Men coming into your home and hurting you? No. The people who did this need to be stopped.
By you?
His smile verges on nasty.
What can you do?
Not me, I tell him. The police.
The English police.
He spits the words with disdain.
Stupid woman.
Abe stalks to the door, opens it using his uninjured hand.
Leave us. Now. Stay away from my wife. Stay away from me. And if you know what's good for you, you'll keep your mouth shut.
Never taking my eyes from his, I cross to the door. Instead of going through it, I loosen his grip, close it, and turn to face him. That isn't the Amish way. Abe narrows his eyes, cocks his head.
You don't act like an Amish woman.
I am as Amish as you are, I shoot back, but I don't tolerate violence. Evidently, you do. He looks down at the floor. I wait. They came here, Mary says after a moment, 2 nights ago. Who? The couple exchanges a look. Mary turns away and crosses to the door, twists the knob lock. There's no bolt lock. Abe sighs tiredly and looks away.
Can't say.
Were they on snowmobiles? I ask. When he doesn't answer, Mary turns to face me. Yeah. Why did they come here?
To tell us to stay away from you,
she tells me.
You're not one of us. You're an outsider and not to be trusted.
For an instant, I wonder if my cover has been compromised. Uneasiness quivers in my gut. Then I realize she's referring to the Amish edict of separation. Because I'm from Ohio? I ask. Because I'm not a member of the church district? Or is it something else?
You don't know the rules here, Abe says. You don't know how things are done.
Exactly how are things done? I send a pointed look toward his hand, the huge bandage, the blood soaking through. What did they do to you? The Amish man looks away. I'm about to try again, when Mary speaks. When she does, her voice is so low, I have to lean close to hear.
They cut off his finger.
A shudder rises in my chest, but I tamp it down. Who? We think it was Jacob Yoder and Jonas Smucker, she replies. They were wearing ski masks, but I knew. We've known them since they were boys. Abe jerks his head